This is Hollywood Outsider, our weekly entertainment podcast. We've got a new episode available every single week at thehollywoodoutsider.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, your favorite podcast app, whatever you use. My name is Aaron Peterson, and I am going to be your host for this special episode of The Hollywood Outsider. As our loyal listeners know, every once in a while, we like to bring you interviews with filmmakers to give you an insight into both what goes into getting their projects made, as well as insight into the respective art itself. For this episode, I am speaking with Jim Cummings, writer, director, and star of Thunder Road. And it opens at the funeral for Officer Jim Arnaud's mother. Jim, who's played by Jim Cummings, is a slender man. He's got a handsome face, nice 70s cop mustache, and he's begun delivering his mother's eulogy. As he attempts to do so, he has a wave of conflicted emotions that washes over him. And for the next 10 uncut minutes, we sit and watch as Jim, the actor and the character, bounces back and forth between anger and guilt and sorrow and pain and anguish. Also, a lot of comedy. There's a lot of uncomfortable comedy here. And as the movie continues, we see that Officer Jim is at a bit of a crossroads. Like so many of us, losing a parent kind of causes a rift that becomes difficult for him to deal with. He struggles with her loss. He also begins to understand he might not be the best father or cop around. And then he ends up in a custody battle for his daughter, while also fighting for his job as a police officer. There's a lot going on, and if you watch just the trailer, I think it paints it as a strict drama, and it's not. It's definitely a comedy drama. There's a lot of comedy here, a lot of stuff we would laugh at in people's lives. And if you read my review, which is on the website, I reference early Tom Hanks, and I mean that. It's very reminiscent to me of Tom Hanks before he got all Hanksy. You know, it's like Nothing in Common and Big and A League of Their Own, that those kinds of films where he mixed comedy and drama. That's what this performance is. It's not often do I get a chance to witness a performance from an actor I'm not familiar with and just sit there in awe of it. And that's what I felt as I watched this. And the reason why it's special to me that we're talking to Jim Cummings is because when I saw this film at South by Southwest, and I talk about this a little bit in the interview, it was easily my favorite from the show. It was easily my favorite film that I saw this year. I was shocked at how great this movie was, and I really just wanted to get a bigger canvas. It's coming out on video on demand at the end of October. It's been playing in select theaters right now, so you can still look around, see if you can see it in a theater, because I think it'd be great to see with an audience if you can't get it on video on demand. I've already bought my copy from iTunes. I've already pre-ordered it. Even though I've seen the movie twice, I still want to own it. I just think it's great. I think it's one of the best movies of the year, and I don't say that often, and I don't say that lightly. You know, enough of me rambling. Let's just get into it. Here's my interview with writer, director, and star of Thunder Road, Jim Cummings.
Hey, this is Jim Cummings. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. I've had this crazy day. My friends went into labor like a month prior to the delivery date. So like kind of everybody's been rallying around, and there's a thousand things that they had to get done before the delivery. And so I've been driving around LA all day. It's a funny day.
Well,
how are you?
Well, if you need to reschedule, that's fine. I mean, I
understand that. No. I'm totally fine. I had to be there for a delivery of a nursery rocking chair at 2 PM. So I think I'm off duty for the next couple of hours, which is good.
Well, that's a great friend. There you go.
Yeah, no, it was fun. It was fun. It was like we got the phone call in the middle of the day when we were out by the pool, and I was like, oh, shit. Oh, God. Oh, no, we have to go. We have to go right now. I was like, no, it was fine. It was good.
Like I'd say, I was at the South by premiere for Thunder Road.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, I
no
was.
No way.
When we got the press release for it, I just jumped because there's two movies that premiered there that I just kept thinking, like, there are two movies of this festival that definitely deserve, like, a huge canvas. And this was one of them. This is a great movie.
I mean, let me think. Was the other one Prospect?
No. I mean, if you want me to say, I will. I don't want to.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen. I actually didn't get a chance to see many of the films in the program. Like, it's very difficult to get tickets. The amount of stuff that was happening in Austin at the time, we were only there for 4 days or something like that. And a lot of our crew was from Austin, so we ended up hanging out with them instead of being able to see the film.
No, well, the other one was Family, which is ridiculous. I don't know anything about the Insane Clown Posse. I don't know anything about them, but that movie was hysterical and unique. It was unique.
Yeah, I saw another doc that was that one kickstarted. I remember seeing something. It was a Kickstarter campaign for a movie about Juggalos, and it is a really crazy community. I know nothing about that, but it is this insane thing that happens specifically in America that is this weird microculture, and they are very tight. That's interesting. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's they were some of them were there. That was interesting to hear them hooting and whatever their call outs are. Yeah.
How weird. How fucking bizarre. But that's South by Southwest. South by Southwest like programs the fringe culture stuff. It's cool.
Were you expecting the response that you got for Thunder Road when you dropped this bomb on South by? Because you got an overwhelming response. You won Grand Jury Prize. I mean, it was across the board.
Yeah.
Praise.
Yeah, we were very lucky. No, I wasn't. I tend not to, as a rule, to not be expectant. And the same thing with the short. At most, I dreamed that it would be a Vimeo staff pick short film. Like, I didn't think that it would do well. And it was a weird project. I knew it was good. I knew it was a good showcase of my abilities and performance and comedy and drama, and I knew that Pixar movies were really popular and they worked with audiences and that they were very funny and very sad and very poignant, and so I was just following in those footsteps I had no idea that it was going to do that well at South by Southwest. And it was kind of perfect too, like we shot it in Austin, and so duly people in the crowd were like, you know, excited that it was something shot in Texas. And then also like it was based off of the short, and it's in the opening scene is very different from the short. And so like, I assumed that most of the people in that premiere you were at had seen the short film. And so when the boombox doesn't work, it kind of became this inside joke. And so, yeah, no, there was 1,000 tiny unexpected things that made the audience very engaged in the film.
All right, we'll definitely come back to that. I got to ask you 2 questions before we come back to Thunder Road, though. First one, important question to me. When did you know you wanted to get involved in filmmaking? Was there a specific moment in your life? Was it a lifelong dream? Or just did something happen where Jim Cummings said, I got to do this?
No, not really. I mean, I knew I got a laptop. I got an iMac or an iBook back in the day. Those ones that were like the ones with the handles on them that were blue and white. And I had one of those that my brother got me, and it had iMovie on it. And so I'd always loved movies. I watched movies growing up for, you know, years and years and years. And my brother and I used to always watch movies and also just bullshit. Like we were always coming up with stupid scenarios and making each other laugh and just coming up with different dialogue. And I didn't know that was going to prep us to write dialogue in the future. It was just something that was funny. I grew up with 5 sisters and 2 brothers. And so like any jokes that we could come up with was entertaining on a long van ride or at dinner. My brother's 2 years older than me, John. And I knew that I was good at creating scenarios, but I never dreamed that I'd be a filmmaker. And then in high school, I was making smaller stuff that wasn't very good. And it was just like me running around my friends on the day, coming up with a good idea for a movie and then editing it because we had access to editing software with my iBook. And then I applied to film school and got in, and I was like, all right, well, fuck it. I'll go to film school. And I had some preliminary editing in iMovie. I didn't have Final Cut Pro. I couldn't afford it. And I didn't have really any other editing software. And so I went to Emerson College in Boston to direct and be the filmmaker, which is the dream that everybody is sold, that you can go to film school and become a writer and director. And then I was making stuff in school that wasn't that great, that was trying to be Louis Malle and not really understanding, you know, audiences or what people found interesting. And I graduated and I made movies that weren't that good. And I was terrified to make movies anymore because I felt like I wasn't very good at it. And I was, I guess, like discouraged and maybe even just self-discouraged. And then I spent about 4 or 5 years, maybe 6 years producing for other people. So I was producing for Danny Madden and Patrick Wang and Tony Ascenda, who now have these illustrious careers as directors. And I was just kind of a non-creative producer. But in riding their coattails, I was able to go to film festivals and see the movies that were programmed. And so I was able to see shorts programs from around the world, South by Southwest or Cannes or, you know, anywhere. And so I feel like I had my metronome reset to what was actually good, what audiences and what people who saw every movie, every short film that year found culturally significant. And so I was like, all right, cool. Like probably 90% of it, I was like, my God, that was incredible. I'll never be able to make something that good. But then the other 10%, I was like, I could do something better than that. And then that became ambition. And I was working at a company called College Humor at the time. I was seeing stuff that was getting made and getting appreciated that wasn't really that funny. I don't know why I was getting appreciated. And then I was just like, all right, well, fuck this. Just let me try it. And then that became the Thunder Road short film. And I wrote it on my car rides to work. I was commuting from North Hollywood to West Hollywood. And then I was like writing it there and back. And in 2 months, it was ready to shoot. And we shot it in 6 hours and then submitted it to Sundance on a whim. It was late. I like had to reach out on Twitter for a deadline waiver and didn't think that we'd get in. Didn't think that anybody would respond to it or respond to me on Twitter. And then like a week later, the Sundance programmer said, hey, sorry, we get 300 requests a day. Here's a deadline waiver. And I submitted it blindly. I didn't know anybody. And then we got in and won that year, 2016. And then, yeah, that was kind of my experience of becoming a filmmaker, was just watching other people flail and then trying to correct them from flailing and focusing on the right stuff and not being able to. And then me saying, all right, well, I'll just try it myself.
I hope that inspires people. Sincerely, that's a great story.
Me too, man. And it's kind of become my job. Like, for years, I thought that the Damien Chazelles of the world and the Jared Hesses and Lena Dunhams were these billboards that you see on the highway from casinos of like, hey, this person won big. You should try it yourself. but really, there is truth in that. Like, I was a nobody. Like, I didn't have, I mean, I'd been on sets a lot. And I knew how to organize sets. But I was just like a dude who had a Reddit account and like had my ear to the ground on what people on the internet thought was funny and what people actually laughed at and what people actually cried at. And I think that probably primed me to be a storyteller. I mean, obviously genetically that helps as well. And my dad always used to tell stories growing up. And I had all of these influences that I realized a lot of people might not be privileged to have. And I was lucky, but yeah, I end up being in the middle of this Venn diagram that I think probably thousands of people are in, but there's just such discouragement in the industry and in, I don't know, in society and culture generally of like, no, you have to go through the system and you have to spend your whole life imagining that someone's going to come along and pluck you up out of obscurity instead of just doing it yourself and spending a Saturday with your friends making a movie.
I have a hard time, and seriously, it's not hyperbole, it's not because you're here. I have a hard time believing that you weren't already, when I watched the movie, I'm with a bunch of fellow critics, and we're all watching it, and we're, you know, laughing, we're crying. I mean, it's a very up-and-down movie. The character of Jim runs through every single emotion that I think has ever been registered on the human scale. And as I'm watching it, I actually turned to another critic and said, do you know him? Because I had not seen the short. I honestly did not know. I'm like, why have I not seen him in 1,000 things? Because he's great. He's fantastic.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thanks. Before the short, that was my first time acting. And like, that was it. I knew what good acting looked like. I knew, like, I'm a fan of De Niro and, you know, Marlon Brando and Jack Lemmon and Chris Lilley and Steve Coogan. And it's like, I just kind of watched them. But no, dude, like that, no, I knew in the writing process that it was making me cry and that it was making me laugh. And I thought, well, let's just push that. Let's just like, fuck it. You know, I was focused on engagement and hitting people like Pixar movies do to me. Yeah. That became the writing process. It's all oral. It was never really written. It's like I acted out every scene in my friend's basement with a voice memo app on the iPhone. And then I'll record the good stuff. So I'll act it out 1,000 times or 100 times when it's working. When I have a good line of dialogue, I'll go, oh, that's good. And then I'll like record it in my phone. And then I'll just transcribe those recordings to screenplay format later. And then that became the screenplay.
That's great. Well, so explain this to me. So Thunder Road started off as a short, essentially a variation of the first 10 minutes of the movie as your character grieves wildly at his mom's funeral. What inspired both that short? Well, you kind of talked about what inspired the short, but the idea to make this an entire film, what inspired that?
I guess I always liked the guy, and it was like it's definitely like a more sad or pathetic version of me, or like the Ghost of Christmas Future. Like I'm a divorcee. This life could have been mine had I stayed in the South and had a daughter, but no, I don't know. Like I did 9 other single take short films after Thunder Road short, and then was struggling to get anybody to take it seriously. And I had written the feature and went to all of the different outlets that are there to supposedly support people who are trying to turn their shorts into features, and production companies and studios, and everybody said, "Oh, but you want to act in it." And I said, yeah. And they were like, well, if you can get Sam Rockwell or Jude Law, then that would be great. And I was like, all right, well, I don't know those guys. I could kind of see if they're on Facebook or something like that. But no, I don't know. I realized I should just, I don't know, tap the people around me that were doing cool stuff, that were enthusiastic and talented. Zach Parker was this producer who was at AMC Networks and was leaving. And he's a buddy, and I sent him a copy of the screenplay of the feature. And he was like, I want to leave my job, and I want this to be my first feature that I produce of 5 features in Texas.
Oh, wow.
And he had never produced a feature before. And I was like, all right, yeah, let's see about it. And let's see if we can do it. And he said, I'll put up $50,000. You put up $50,000. And I had just done these Kahlua commercials, and I had the money. And I was like, all right, cool. I believe in the project. Let's do it. And then we ran a Kickstarter campaign, and we raised $36,000 in a month. From relatively strangers, friends and family, and then like really loving strangers who are now good friends of ours and financiers of ours. And we were able to shoot the movie for under $200,000 in Austin in 14 days in November of 2017. And I don't know, it was just like the script was good enough, and it was making me laugh and cry more than any of the projects that I was working on. And I was like, well, there's a sign. Like, this is one of those weird life-affirming movies. And it's kind of this amalgamation of my thought process about grief and loss, and it might help people. Like, the dream is that somebody's going through hell and then sees this character going through hell and sees him survive it and then goes, okay, I can survive this.
Well, it's powerful, especially the journey that Jim has, because he's not written and he's not played as just a perfectly balanced person. He's a good person.
Nuts.
No, he's narcissistic, sarcastic at times. He's a person.
Yeah. He's a fucking armed gunman at times. Like, he's, yeah. Yeah, it's a 360. When for a long time, we had a screener available, and the password was pirouette, which is what a ballerina does to show off a full 360 of their person. And that was it. We said that the whole time we were shooting, it's like, we have to use every part of the buffalo. If we're showing this guy, then this is it. This is the one shot we have in defining this macho fucking nutcase and wholesome father and America and Bruce Springsteen. Like, we have to fucking see every part of this guy. Yeah. I'm proud of it.
Yeah, and the title refers to the Bruce Springsteen song about Mary, her boyfriend, and their one last chance to make it real, if I remember right. Are you a big Bruce Springsteen fan? How did you come to that particular song?
Don't get me started. Yeah, no, I am. it kind of accidentally. It was one of those weird self-fulfilling prophecies. My mom is a huge fan. My mom used to talk about, my mom's still alive. My mom and dad both came to the theatrical release in France on the 12th, and we get to like roam around Paris, and it was great fun. But my mom, for years when we were growing up, would talk about this song and this guy with such reverence of, like, he was this dude who encouraged people to change their lives if they were unhappy. And that, I don't know, like, I remember just this like folk tale of this man. And I actually had that experience in the short film where my dad and my mom were in the car and I put on Thunder Road, and, or maybe it was Born to Run. I forget which song it was, but my dad was a trial attorney through the 80s and 90s and probably didn't listen to the radio as much as he should. Probably listened to a lot of Willie Nelson, but not enough Bruce. But my mom was like right at the cusp of that generation where it meant something to that time in America, and she knew every lyric, she knew every word. And it was funny as like a 23-year-old to see my mom light up and like love this guy. And I don't know, I was driving home from this work function in 2015, late 2015, miserable, and that song came on the radio, and I found myself crying for 3 hours. I knew every word of the song, but I was 28, and I was just thinking about what that song meant to generations of people around the planet. My mom, and just getting out and changing your life if you're unhappy. And the gravity of it hit me just very hard, and it still does. And so it had to be that song. And I was thinking about that. A friend of mine told me about a friend of his who sang a song at a funeral. And my first reaction was, did anybody film that? I would love to see what that looks like. And he said, no, why would somebody film that? And I said, oh, I'm sorry. Fuck me. Yeah. And then I heard the song on the radio, and I was like, well, that's the song that I would sing. And what if I fucked it up? What if what if I was grieving and it wouldn't sound very good, and that would be very funny. And I'd just seen Inside Out, the Pixar film, in theaters. And I was like, laughing and crying while thinking about this idea. And it had to do with Bruce, and it had to do with this thing. And I was like, I think other people would relate to this thing. It's like a bit of pop culture mixed with humanity. And it was also about the police in late 2015. And I don't know, it worked. And I was like, this is the thing that I have to do before I die. And I spent like $6,000 or $7,000 of my own money and my savings. I sold my wedding rings to finance the short film. And it paid off. I'll never make that money back. I mean, that money, like, the short is going to be online for free because of our deal with Bruce, who's been really lovely. But that really was the thing that started my career.
Wow. So Bruce is well aware of that, Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So after we submitted it to Sundance without the rights, very stupidly, and then we won. And then I thought, okay, well, now we're never going to be able to put this thing online. And then I spent 4 months trying to get him a copy of it. And we got in touch with his manager, and we sent it to him, and he passed it on, and he said, yes, Bruce has seen the short film. Thank you so much for sharing it. And I was like, well, how do we ask him to be able to give us the rights? And we're talking to these people who are quoting us just more money than you could imagine to mm-hmm. be able to have it online for free. And so I just wrote an open letter on medium.com and said, hey, dear Bruce, I'm trying to do this thing. And I tweeted about it, and then I posted on Facebook, and we had like 175 people share it or something like that. Not much, but still enough. And we got a phone call over the next 2 days saying, yeah, that's fine. You can put it up. Give us $1,000 every year, and check in every year, and we'll see if we still agree in the next year. And every year I've checked in, and they said, yeah, that's fine. And I write a check to Bruce Springsteen, not to a management company, not to a label, to Bruce Springsteen. And it's a very interesting, special relationship. Yeah, that's how we did it.
That's pretty awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, we're very lucky.
I want to talk to you a little bit about some of your choices in the movie. You take several, I would say, bold stances by holding the camera on your character for minutes at a time as he has mental breakdowns of sorts. And
yep.
to illustrate that for the audience, so Jim's character will run through a gamut of emotions during these moments: anger, despair, humiliation, hilarity. And it's a brave choice as an actor, but as a director, I got to say it's even bolder because you're the one in front of the camera. I don't know how many takes you had to do that. What inspired you to shoot Thunder Road in this way? Because it happens more than once, and it looks like it would be hard to get as right as you got it.
Yeah, again, we're very lucky, not just in that we got it each time and captured the footage, but also the team was so incredible that we were able to do it so quickly and capture those moments so effectively. Yeah, so for the opening scene, we shot it 18 times. The first 9 times we used the song just as it is in the short film. And the last 9 times we shot it without the song as it appears in the feature. And there was a small break for lunch in between. So I had to do it 18 times roughly that day. And there were times where I wasn't crying and it wasn't working. And I would say, nope. And then we'd reset and go back in the middle of the take if we knew we weren't going to use it. Mm-hmm. And then the last take that we used was after a kind of long non-conversation that I had with my producer that was a long time coming. My producer, Natalie, had just lost a family member to a drunk driving accident 2 weeks prior. And I was doing the scene and got about 16 takes into it and said, I can't do it anymore. I can't cry anymore. I'm sorry. We have to stop. And then she took her earpiece out and turned her walkie-talkie off. And I have never cried so hard in my life. And then we shot that last take that made it into the film. It's hell, dude. the set is hell on purpose. We structured it that way to put this guy through hell to make the most cathartic ending possible. And there was a time where I transitioned from being this writer-director into the character actor, where I was like, and then we're going to have him jump fences and slam into the fence, and I'm going to have him fall down. And then I went, I'm going to fall down. And then the whole crew kind of clapped for a second, where I was like, that was 2 days or a day before we started shooting. And I was like, oh shit, this is going to have to be me. But we planned that. Like, the whole time we're talking about that is like, it should never be easy. If it's ever easy, that's a problem, and that's not going to show to an audience. It's supposed to be hard. If it wasn't hard, everyone would do it. The hard is what makes it great, to quote Tom Hanks from League of Their Own. But no, there was like, there were moments where we shot the parking lot scene. At the end of the day, having shot the other parking lot scene where I tackled the transient homeless guy that morning. So we shot that 3 or 4 times, and then moved locations to then shoot the climax of the movie, where I take all my clothes off and shout at everybody in a parking lot. And it was grueling. It was the same day we shot both of those. But the crew was so well oiled that on the fourth day, that it was like, all right, this is nothing new. We shot the funeral scene the first day. People had already seen what I was willing to put myself through, and we just kept pushing it. Yeah, man, it shows. It is, that was important to me, to feel very close to the guy. And from the short film, sorry to answer your question, we chose not to have any coverage of showing the audience in either of those scenes of where the camera slowly zooms in on me in the church. Mm-hmm. You're getting to know the guy, and so you're getting closer to him. And then nothing else matters. Like, if we end up showing somebody in the crowd and they raise one eyebrow, that says, this is a comedy. Or if they're crying, that says, this is supposed to be a drama. But if you don't show anybody in the crowd, if it's just him in the frame, the audience is then forced to come up with their own ideas of what they should be feeling. And that's exactly where you want any audience for any movie.
I like that. And that's true. Yeah, I would say that's true. If you show me other people laughing, I probably would have thought, oh, they're planning this whole thing for laughs. But I was up and down with him. Just like, I don't know if I'm supposed to root for him or not. I don't know.
Yep. 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 And you're thinking, this guy's a police officer. Where's he going to go after this? Or should this guy have a gun? Or is it okay to humanize the police in 2018? Is that an okay thing to do? Like, all of those emotions go on when you don't show any of the audience. And so that was crucial. And then we end up like talking about all that stuff. Like, he pulls a gun on his partner. I don't know. I think all of that was in the DNA of the project, of how to best tell the story. And it took, 2 months beforehand of having conversations, fighting an uphill battle with myself and the team of like, is it okay that we don't have coverage? Is it okay that we just show these moments? And I was like, I think so. This works in like Michael Haneke films. This works in like Ken Loach movies. I think we're good. And then we shot it. We didn't have any other coverage. So I was like, all right, I guess we can move on. I guess we can go to lunch or like move locations now.
When you're doing a 10-minute scene, because, you know, it doesn't cut, do you improv that at all? I assume there's got to be some improv. Or
none.
Is it completely none. Really?
You're not allowed to have any. With long takes, I have to be exactly in the right spot every time. The camera has to be in focus every time. They have to know where I'm going to land every time. The boom mic has to be in the right spot. You can't have wobble in the boom mic. There are moments in the parking lot scene where I couldn't walk far enough, because if I walked too far, DeForest, who's one of our actors, was going to be blocking me. So all of that is planned out. Like, there's no room at all. So I have to rehearse it 1,000 times. And there are times where in the rehearsal, I mean, that's the benefit of also being the director. I don't think Daniel Day-Lewis has this kind of say, but it's like, if I'm shouting and I know, if I'm in a golf course, which is where I was rehearsing at night, which is across the street from my producer's house where I was staying, I could go out there and rehearse this thing and do it 15 times and then go, okay, cool. On the day, I need DeForest standing over here. I need Nike in here. Y'all have to be over here. And then like in this one moment, the camera's going to move over and showcase these guys. It's like all of that is planned out. There's no, there are four lines of improv in the short film. I say, we got people here. And that is the only line that is different from the other takes that we got.
Wow. That's really, it's not hard to believe. It's just once you've seen it, it's hard to comprehend.
Seems maybe authentic.
Because
it's written out loud. And so it sounds authentic. It's also written by the person who's delivering lines.
Makes it easier.
So it sounds authentic.
And how did you come to select Kendall Farr for your daughter, Crystal? And did you have to build that kinship?
So we had a casting director named Vicky Boone, who's really wonderful. She cast Tree of Life as well. So she has a good history of casting young people in Texas. And she brought in about 40 girls between 6 and 12. And Kendall was one of them. And there were about 3 good candidates. And then I met Kendall and said, we have to make this movie and we have to make it with her. And I can't do it without this girl. And she was just so loving. She was just so empathetic and also very funny. And she was off book when she came into the rehearsal. She came into the audition. She was off book. And yeah, she was just able to do it so well. And it shows. I mean, every scene she's in, she's really calm and cool and a shithead. And
she's a kid.
Yeah, a kid. And you empathize for her. You want them to connect, which was the whole point of the character. And she was also just very loving on set. She was very much my daughter. Like, there were scenes that we'd be shooting other scenes in, like, the police station and, you know, that we'd be shooting something later, but she wanted to come on set and surprise us and hang out. And she would be, like, climbing on me while we were shooting other scenes. And I'd be like, honey, stop, hold on, I'm trying to write the scene. And, like, she was always leaning against me, or she was always hugging me. It was like, we developed this relationship very quickly. We still have that relationship. Like, anytime I see her, when we were at South by Southwest, I was carrying her across the street. I was giving piggyback rides. It's like, she just seems like this niece of mine or something like that. And she kind of became this kind of family member. And she has that effect on everybody. Like, everybody on set loved her. And she's just this wonderfully thoughtful person and professional. Like, I was having trouble crying for the ambulance scene, and I was listening. All my normal tricks weren't working. I was listening to Bob Dylan, and I was like kind of crouching on the lawn, and she was in the ambulance, and she jumped out and just came up to me and was like asking me if I needed any help. And then she hugged me. And then that was the thing that made me cry. And then she was like, all right, let's go, let's go. And then she jumped into the car. She was 9. She's 9 years old. And she knew that she needed to help. And then we shot the scene. She's amazing. I can't say nicer things about her.
She's going to be in the business for a while then.
I hope so. I hope for the rest of us too. Yeah, I get to watch more movies with her.
So I read your IndieWire story from, I think it was yesterday, where the distribution deals were a little thin after South By and winning all these festival awards and everything else. So you went a different route, but what do you attribute that to? I mean, is it just because there's an oversaturation of independent films, or what did you see as the problem there?
No. So I see you. Okay. So two different questions here. The first one is why we decided to self-distribute. And the other one is why there was such a thin offer. Right now, there are so many film distributors and it's become so predatory, the market, because it's so easy to distribute a film now. It costs around $1,100 to get your film on iTunes, which is not much money. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, if you're charging $9, $9.99 to buy the movie, that's not many times that you have to sell it. And then it's on there forever. So you can be receiving checks for the next 100 years. But because there's such a lack of knowledge of film marketing and film distribution amongst filmmakers, these film distributors come in and offer predatory contracts to own the thing. And the other scary thing is that these distributors have these incredible overheads. These, like, they have, you know, 10 to 15 people working at the company with these beautiful offices in Brooklyn, and they're very cool, and like all that shit that ends up going into their pockets instead of, and their lifestyles instead of filmmakers. There's a good number. They said that last year, accumulatively, 18% of the wealth generated from the music industry in 2017 went to the musicians.
Oh, wow. That's just sad.
Which is, it's crazy. And it's probably the same with, mm-hmm. it might be even crazier with the film industry. I don't know if it's been tabulated in recent years. But it's that kind of a market right now. And we bet that they were all liars and that we should do it ourselves. So we read the Sundance case study for Columbus, which, if you haven't read, is a phenomenal document, where the movie cost $750,000. They got offers of like $200,000 after it screened at Sundance. It like had a huge release at Sundance, has a very famous movie star in it, John Cho. And they still couldn't get offers that would keep them above the poverty line. And so they said, all right, well, fuck it. We'll see what we can do. And Sundance gave them a grant to be able to release the film. And they were able to recoup in the first year $650,000. And our movie only cost $200,000. And so we thought, okay, well, they are doing well by themselves. Why don't we do it? Like, we kind of had no other offer. We had an offer of $100,000 tops globally. That was our offer. It was like a global deal with a subsidiary of a large studio. And that was the only and the best offer that we got. Yeah. And that was even after Cannes. Like, we still didn't get any offers. And then we met with Pan Am, this distribution company in France, because of the program that we were in Cannes, the ACID program, which is specifically meant for finding distribution for films. We were the fourth best reviewed film in 2018's Cannes Film Festival. And then we were the 25th best reviewed film in Cannes history, and still we couldn't get anybody to give us any money for our movie.
That's insane.
And so we thought, dude, it's bad, man. It's bad. It is so predatory.
I'm telling you, I walked out of the festival thinking I'm going to be seeing that movie come awards time. I'm not seriously, just because you're here. I told friends that. It's one of those movies where I think it's unique, it's original, it's taking chances, it's also human. You know, there's a lot of it. It hits all the quadrants. So I'm actually really
shocked. That's very kind of you. That's very kind of you. We don't care about awards, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I just don't. But that's very kind of you. It is strange to put as much work into something, though, and then to not have, or to, at least to get the acclaim. Like, you think that these things are worth something. Or if they are worth anything, they should be worth this. But like, if you win something, you should at least get people to be able to see the film. But that's not the film market, because it's becoming so democratized, and because these distributors spend so much money on themselves, it costs them a lot of money to run their companies. And because of that, they're running them into the ground. And so with the Sundance case study, with this creative distribution fellowship that we're a part of, we really hope to inspire the next generation of filmmakers to follow in our footsteps and the Columbus team's footsteps, and really put these people out of careers, because they've been so predatory to our neighbors and our peers for the last 20 years. And it's very easy now. It's just Facebook ads. You just have to have a Facebook page and save budget or run a Kickstarter campaign to market. And nobody will tell you that, because you become the competition if you hear that. And so everyone will discourage you from doing it yourself.
Man, kudos to you for finding another way. Because you guys actually just went to France, right? And had a pretty big impact there with the release.
Yes.
Still haven't.
We released, bro, crazy. I'm tempted to move. Cassavetes did it. Fucking Charlie Chaplin did it. We released the film in theaters across France. It was supposed to be about 15 theaters across France, 12 to 15. That was what we were banking on. Two in Paris. That was like the hope. That was everybody that said yes to us after all of our phone calls with Pan Am, our distributor over there. They're lovely. It's about five people, and it's all these incredible women who just love movies and love supporting movies, and we're very lucky. And then we were also in tandem, I was going there for the Deauville Film Festival. So Cannes is this like big film festival that's international, and it says like, this is what the world likes. But then Deauville is this big French film festival where it's like for French people, like this is what French people like. And so I knew of the festival beforehand, but I didn't realize how big of a sway it had. So, you know, I show up and I got a new suit for the festival, and I was, you know, going out on the carpet and shaking hands and kissing babies. And then we won very unexpectedly. And we had 67 theaters call us across France, 10 in Paris, saying we want the movie. And then it did so well in the first 4 days that we had 11 more theaters reach out and expand for the second week. And now we have 10 more theaters for the third week. And within the first week, the first 6 to 7 days that we were in theaters, we made 180,000 euros from ticket sales. That's $210,000. That's 10 grand more than the budget of the film, just from theatrical in the territory of France alone. So when we sell the TV rights in France, hopefully with Canal Plus in the next couple of weeks, we'll make, you know, probably half of that again. And then when it goes to DVD and Blu-ray, we'll probably do the same. And that's just from one country where English is their second language. And I cannot tell you how much value there is in doing it yourself. Like, in owning the film and putting it out yourself and not going through these systems that are there to fuck over artists, you can have a living. And people don't want you to know that. They want you to think that you have to go through their system so that they can take all of your money and your rights away from you. And that has been the opposite of our experience in making and releasing this film. And we get to say all of that through Sundance. It's great. If I was doing it by myself in a van, driving around and yelling at people with a megaphone, I'd seem like a crazy person. But because Sundance is doing it, nobody is giving us any flack. They're like, oh, well, you know, this has credit to it. It's really funny.
Well, I mean, TV just changed because of Netflix. So, I mean, I would think that film distribution needs to go through a little cycle uplift.
Update. I agree.
Then the film will begin rolling out theatrically on October 12th in the States, expanding the 19th. Then it's going to be available on demand October 26th. Do you feel like it's finally coming together? Like the whole it's finally getting out there. You got this done.
It'll never be done. There's a great quote from the film Man Bites Dog. There's a scene of Remy Belleville, rest in peace. But he's talking about the documentary that they're making, this fake documentary about killing people, and it's like falling on a serial killer. And he says, it'll never be done. The film will never be done. And I think about that a lot. It's like this him writhing his hands and like freaking out. I never feel like it'll be done. Even when it's on iTunes, it'll still be something that there's always something to do. And that's how it should be. It's a studio. Like, I'm running a studio, and this is one movie where we're able to sell it and license it to 1,000 different territories over the next 100 years. Our deal with Amazon and with these other platforms are only going to be for 2 years. So in 2 years' time, I'll be able to auction it off to whomever and carve out different territories. This is just one of the properties that we're managing, and we're excited to make a couple more of them.
Well, and lastly, can I thank you for being one of the, if ever, I don't know if I've ever had a director that I've talked to reference Pixar as a story influence. And that's a compliment, because they do great stories. Nobody ever talks about that.
They're the best. Nobody else is doing that. And the other thing is that they're making movies disguised as kids' movies that appeal to both adults and children. And so they're able to hit both markets. And they're like, I think that's the other thing. They're making stuff that isn't sanitized like Disney is. I haven't cried in a Disney movie in forever. And I guess Inside Out is probably the only one, because it's a partnership with Pixar. That's kind of cheating. But no, they are the best storytellers alive right now, I think, because they're not scared to move people. And there's an incredible market right now for independent filmmakers to stand out from the studios who can only make sanitized stuff, because they're making movies for children. Whereas I can slap a corpse. I can curse a lot. I can degrade an American police officer. I can do all of these things that studios can't, and audiences love it, because you can't see that shit in theaters now.
Man, I wish you just a ton of goodwill, like sincerely. Everything.
Oh, thanks, man.
It's really, you sound excited. I know you've got talent, because I've seen the movie, and you've got a plan to do it yourself. And I just think everything that you're talking about is fantastic. That's just awesome.
Oh, thanks so much, dude. Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you.
And what's next for you? Anything after this you already have planned? Are you working on a new project, or are you still kind of mulling it over?
It's a bit of a full-time job distributing the film, but no, I'm writing something with writer-director named Julia Bales. That's this Hitchcockian romantic comedy that's really good. And so we're like one act into writing that one. And then I'm writing something, I've written something that could be cool, that's a werewolf movie where we are in like final closing contracts with a major studio to shoot this winter. but you never know. And I'm still not stopping writing other stuff and never imagining that a dangling carrot is going to come along and I'm actually going to catch it. And instead I'm just waking up and working every day and making something of my own.
Well, sincerely, I love them. That sounds really exciting. Both of those. I love Hitchcock and werewolves. How can you go wrong?
Oh, good. Good. Yeah, either way, if we end up doing either of them, it'll be exciting.
Well, please consider this an open invitation. Come back for your next project. We'd love to have you. I love your work so far. So thanks so much.
Thanks so much, man. Yeah, if you see me posting about anything that involves my next projects, just ping me and I'll come on again.
Okay, sounds good. I appreciate it.
Awesome. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
There you go, guys. I hope you really enjoyed that. Again, Thunder Road is available in select theaters and on demand at the end of October. So if you want to see it in a theater, check now. It's still playing. If you want to get a video on demand, get it. Buy it. Watch it with some friends, man. Get the word out there. I love when independent films like this come along and people just start talking about them. We've really helped a lot of them through our show, and I really hope to help Thunder Road as much as we can. I just feel like this is a movie our audience is going to love. So check it out. Thunder Road, available on demand. Once again, thanks, Jim. Thanks for coming by and doing that. Really appreciate it. And thank you guys for listening to the Hollywood Outsider podcast. We try to bring you interviews with filmmakers in the world of independent cinema when we can. So I really hope you enjoyed this one. Remember to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. Our normal show has a new episode every single week and is available at thehollywoodoutsider.com as well as all those podcast apps. This is Aaron Peterson reminding you that the next time you head into the theater or sit comfortably on your couch with your friends watching Thunder Road, buy popcorn.